How do we deal with risk of war, of disease, of climate change, and how do we respond to it? Well, the quick answer seems to be not very well. According to a man who spent a career navigating military risk, retired General Stanley McChrystal. McChrystal commanded U.S. forces in Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010, and we'll talk about that as well as his new book, Risk, A User's Guide. He co-wrote it with Anna Butrico. General McChrystal, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Now, this book goes into a lot of tragedies where the risks were somewhat known beforehand. You write about the pandemic, about 9/11, about Pearl Harbor. And yet, so many times, governments, businesses, organizations didn't respond to risk well. Is that part of why you wrote this book?
It's exactly why I wrote the book. I went through a lifetime of people focusing on external threats or risks, but then not responding well. And I came to the conclusion that the greatest risk to us is actually us.
Yeah, and you write about that a lot. I mean, you go into a lot of factors in the book, ingredients there. We can't get into all of them. But yes, you say the greatest risk is to us. So that is focusing not just on the risk kind of out there, but how we in here kind of understand and respond to it. Is that what you mean?
Well, that's exactly right. If we think of risk or threats as things that are external and we can't do much about it, but we try to build Maginot lines or do other things, we often forget that we have the opportunity, in fact, I would argue, the responsibility to make our organizations better prepared to deal with risk. You mentioned that we cover COVID-19 in the book, and it's almost a perfect proof case that, in fact, a threat that was coming that was knowable, and it was inevitable because pandemics do come so often, and we have a good body of public health knowledge, we didn't respond too well. And that was our fault, not the strength of the threat.
And for leaders out there who are leading military organizations, businesses, families, sports teams, you argue for managing risk the way the human body does. Tell me briefly about what you mean.
That's exactly right. When we started thinking about risk, we realized it's very much like the human immune system. Now, you and I have a miracle in our bodies. Every day we are assaulted by an estimated 10,000 pathogens that could harm us or kill us. But we don't get up in the morning worrying about it because it just happens. Unless we get autoimmune deficiency or something else that weakens our ability to fight off risks. So on a constant basis, our body detects threats, assesses them as to whether they're dangerous to us, responds, defeats, destroys them, and then learns from it so it's better next time. In reality, organizations or societies writ large have the same thing, and it's a risk immune system. And so it detects, assesses, responds, and learns from that. But when it doesn't work well, when we are unable to do basics like communication, or if we don't have a diverse set of perspectives so we get a clear picture, what we've done is we've increased our vulnerabilities. We really can't do much about the specifics of threats, but we have tremendous control over those vulnerabilities. And there's some very straightforward things that an organization can do to strengthen itself, even when it doesn't have perfect clarity on what threats it'll have to face.
You mentioned having a diverse set of opinions in the room, and I just want to share one anecdote I had reporting 10 years ago in Japan after the tsunami. At the time, one management expert in Japan said, you know, I see the same thing with the tsunami flooding this nuclear plant and the 2008 financial crisis and the Enron crisis, same movie. And he said, the issue is insular cultures, right, that are not welcome to uncomfortable questions. Does that kind of get to your point here?
It does. In the book, we discuss the Bay of Pigs fiasco in 1961. And the new President Kennedy inherits a task to invade Cuba with some expatriates. It's not a good idea, and it's not a very good plan. But the insular culture that was created at the beginning of his administration caused it to be executed with disastrous results. And interesting, they studied it afterward, and a man named Irving Janis came up with the term groupthink, which we all use all the time now. Mm. And then you go even 18 months later, for the Cuban Missile Crisis, and suddenly President Kennedy has a much more diverse set of perspectives. He opens the aperture He gets more options, and they get a much better outcome.
So I guess as far as risks and outcomes, I want to ask about Afghanistan, where you, of course, were the top commander in 2009 and 2010. And you write about the inertia of action, military action, begetting more action. And your example is night raids in Iraq and Afghanistan that in the end offended many Afghans because they violated cultural norms. So it seems that in this effort to reduce daylight risk, it created another one and helped undermine the U.S. mission, perhaps. In retrospect, were there a lot of unforeseen risks in real time?
There were, and I would argue that we created many of those risks. We were thinking fairly narrowly, doing operations with tactics that had worked before, had been very effective in Iraq, and were comfortable to us. And so as we go to do that which is familiar to us, we were creating resistance from the Afghan people. First resentment, and then increased resistance. And so what we might get benefit tactically in capturing or killing one or two Taliban leaders was lost in the greater picture because we're making the problem worse.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also want to ask you about Afghanistan in the context of narrative, which you write a lot about. U.S. military and government leaders for two decades, right, time and time again, delivered a hopeful narrative in public. We're winning, we're turning the corner. Yet privately, a lot of the messages were just the opposite, as the Afghanistan Papers book documents. And I want to ask you, as far as risks, did U.S. leaders get trapped in a narrative that kind of hid the real risks that were known?
Well, I'll push back a little on that because I was involved, and most of the reporting that I saw, both internally and some of it externally. Now, I would tell you, though, when you give people a task, they have to buy into that task and they have to become optimistic. We follow leaders who are optimistic. If a coach says we can win, we're much more apt to win because we follow him, we believe and whatnot. I think it's a bit misleading to say that there was deception or stupidity in that. I think in many cases, people saw the situation as they hoped it would be. You know, we want to believe that we're making progress and we're trying to encourage people that progress can be made. So it doesn't make it not a problem. But I want to make sure that we don't buy into this idea that there was this big deception, because I didn't see that. But what I would say is it does open up the risk. And the risk is the challenge of communication, because we tell a story in the book about the Iran rescue mission in 1980. And the people tasked to do the mission go and tell the president there's an 85% chance of success. And I believe they did that absolutely believing that there was an 85%
chance of success. Right, you write that each of the 9 or 10 steps, each had an 85% chance of success. But that wasn't the whole picture, right?
That's right, because probability is 0.9 times 0.9 in that case. And so when we think about our ability to communicate risk, if somebody comes and says, well, how risky is this? And you look at them and you say, it's high risk. High may mean something to you, but it may be very differently defined by that person who's hearing it. And so because much risk defies being perfectly quantified, our challenge in trying to communicate risk clearly is something that we have to take into account as we make decisions.
Okay, finally, just coming back to your book on risk, if I can, for a moment, just gently challenge the premise here. Your book is called Risk, A User's Guide. But when it comes to giant organizations, and you advise some of them, multinational companies, governments, militaries, made up of a lot of people with conflicting incentives and short-term incentives, can these institutions really make these rational decisions about risk the way you're prescribing, or is there too much inertia in the way? You know, what's the reality here?
Yeah, it's a great point. It is hard. And so I would tell you, the first thing they have to do is admit that it is hard and admit that you've got all the different forces and complexities at work so that you don't oversimplify or get yourself overconfident. But the answer is, I think they can do much better than they do, because I think they can make very intentional efforts to cross-level information, to bring as many different perspectives into the problem, to understand the forces, whether it's a, a structure that creates bureaucracy, or whether it's a culture that creates inertia, or whether it's weak leadership. If you look hard at those, you can identify places where there's room for improvement. I think it's really hard to try to make an organization that's got a perfect immune system like we hope our human immune system is. But I think we can make it a lot better than it is. And of course, any incremental improvements can have huge effect on the effectiveness of the organization.
Retired General Stanley McChrystal's new book is called Risk, A User's Guide. He's the co-author. We'll have an excerpt at hereandnow.org. And General, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I appreciate it.